KPCW News Time now, 8:08. And on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Greg. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, those warm temperatures are actually our primary avalanche concern right now. Mountain temperatures remained above freezing. And when that happens, that's sort of a heads up that wet avalanche activity is likely. So temperatures this morning, about 5 degrees warmer than they were on Thursday morning. And Thursday morning, they're about 10 degrees warmer than they were on Wednesday morning. So despite the above freezing temperatures, though, I do think the snow surface will be frozen this morning due to the clear skies. Today's strong sunshine and very warm temperatures, they're going to be producing wet, loose avalanches once the snow surface begins to take on heat. And fortunately, this is a predictable avalanche problem to deal with. So you can expect avalanching in the wet snow once it begins to soften. Something I'd be concerned about would be some being involved in a naturally triggered avalanche that would come down on top of you, especially if you're in some kind of gully or some kind of confined terrain where avalanche debris can pile up deeper and you have no route for escape. I also think that we're going to begin to see wet avalanche activity beginning today on northerly aspects where the colder and drier snow warms up from the strong sunshine. So today we're going, overall avalanche danger is going to be rising to moderate as the snow becomes wet under that strong sunshine and very warm temperatures. And I do think wet avalanches would be possible, both natural and human triggered. Again, they're going to be on the south half of the compass, that is east, south, and west aspects, but also northerly aspects, especially at the low and mid elevations. And timing is everything in this game right now. So move off of and out from underneath steep slopes once the snow surface becomes wet and unconsolidated. And going into this weekend, we're expecting a rising avalanche danger with continued very warm temperatures, near record temperatures, reaching well into the 50s into the mountains, which is quite warm for early April.
Okay, Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's 8:10. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Pat Putt. Later on, Park City Council Member Tim Henney with a recap of last night's meeting. And finally, we'll be talking with the co-chairs of the annual Walk to End Alzheimer's, Andrea and Steve Spalding. They'll have details about the upcoming volunteer kickoff. Joining me now on the phone from Summit County, I have Community Development Director Pat Putt. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's start with, as we always start, any new development applications that have come through the door in the last month.
Well, with a bit of relief, I'm reporting that we haven't, no major new applications of significance or what I consider impacts to the community, smaller plat amendments, those types of things, which if ever there was a point in time to give us a little bit of a reprieve on new applications, this is it. We've, as the listeners would know, we've got a lot of other big issues in front of the planning commissions and the council, particularly in terms of code amendments and general plan amendments. So we're grateful for the opportunity to direct some of our resources towards those.
Okay, little reprieve here. So,
yeah.
Have you received any information about this Garf Ranch City being proposed by Anderson Development?
No, the only information that's come across our desks is just the information that's been provided to us by other sort of third-party sources, some residents out in the area, and what we've learned from listening to KPCW and reading in the paper. No one's reached out to us directly. Other than, I say, you know, some of the local property owners that are trying to understand a bit more about what could potentially happen, what the process for annexations are, those sorts of things. We've, you know, the company name of Anderson Development is out there. We have not spoken with any representatives from Anderson. So it's been quiet on that front in terms of planning and zoning for the county.
Okay. And then there are a number of property owners in Hoytsville who are requesting the Cedar Crest Overlay Zone. What's the latest with that?
Well, hey, it's a good opportunity to let the public know that on Thursday, May 6th, we're going to have a public update and a public comment period on the Cedar Crest Village Overlay process. There isn't a specific final plan done at this point, but the Planning Commission and the applicants feel that it's appropriate to do a check-in with the community and the local neighborhood. The last opportunity that the public actually had to participate, give a voice, was over a year ago in October, when we hosted a big public community open house. So we'll be coming back on May 6th. The downside to a certain degree is it's going to be done through our Zoom platform. As we transition back towards public meetings here in the near horizon, we're not quite there yet, but you know, those limitations known, we're gonna do it on the Zoom format as part of a regular Planning Commission meeting that evening. The idea is to update everyone on what's been developed, the thoughts and the ideas to date. Again, for the listening public, there's about 1,000 acres involved, roughly 26 property owners. We've developed over the course of the last year and a half a series of iterations to a land plan. I wouldn't say that they're three different plans. They're really a refinement of a series of exercises looking at that 1,000 acres. What the committee has been doing recently is breaking those 1,000 acres up into what I'll call smaller sub-neighborhoods. You know, there's a village residential component to the plan. There's a village center. There's a civic component to that. And what the committee's been doing is looking at each of those sub-areas to help better define the nature and the character of each of those. You know, and that includes both what uses would go in there, the scale of the structures that would possibly, you know, be incorporated into there, you know, in terms of residential, the mix of the residential uses. You know, are we talking large lot, estate, big homes? Are we talking more smaller residential lots? Are we talking any multifamily? So we've been reviewing that. We do monthly check-ins with the Planning Commission. Really, what we hope to be able to get some key community input on is the plan as it exists now, as it's forming now, does it actually begin to implement what the original vision that the property owners who have made this application, does it meet that vision that was articulated very on? And the vision had a lot of pieces to it. You know, the property owners were looking to create a cradle to grave community, you know, an opportunity not only for the folks who live there now or their families, you know, who live there now or may come back. You know, if it's possible, can you create a place for, you know, young families to establish themselves as those families grow, a place to, you know, scale up on those sorts of things. And as, you know, individuals get older into the retirement, the downsizing, you know, is there an opportunity to create a place for them without necessarily exporting kids or the, you know, the elderly citizens in the area? Is there an opportunity to create a real civic identity for the community? You know, can we implement amenities like open space and trails? And yeah, and you know, the committee's talking about that. They want to be able to thread those sorts of amenities into this project area as they can. And, you know, can it be done with a way that there is an expectation that over time that they can grow, you know, as rooftops happen, can they grow community services without always not having to drive into Park City, Salt Lake, or Ogden? I think the overall goal, you know, if you could express it in one sort of concept, was probably best articulated by one of the committee members, and that was, you know, can we create a place rather than just a large subdivision? And we think it's time that the public, number one, get a chance to firsthand see where we are in the process, us have an opportunity to allay maybe some fears out there that there is a final project that's coming forward and this is the end product. We're headed in that direction, but we're not there yet. And we need to begin that really important process of testing it with the community. So that'll happen on the 6th. And I, frankly, I'm really looking forward to that meeting because I think we're getting ripe for the input.
All right. The East County Planning Commission last night recommended code changes for campgrounds and RVs last night. Can you just kind of give us an idea what changes? Was it just the fact that you didn't have these in place, and now we do have some kind of planning guidelines?
Well, what we have in place right now with the existing Eastside Code allows the use of vacation. Well, I'm just going to call vacation properties for camping purposes. But beyond that, there's a woeful need of better precision on what, how much, and under what conditions. And again, this is one of these classic cases where when we're going through the code updates, we're attempting to strike a balance, right? There needs to be a balance between a reasonable use of people's property, these vacation properties, you know, up in Manorlands and on the north slope of the Uintas and in the Samick area. You know, people have, you know, purchased property, owned property for a long time that they've been able to go up and enjoy seasonally in the summer and fall, you know, take their camper, their RV, or their tent and use. But as with the rest of the county, you know, we're seeing a lot of growth, and with that growth, there's more of this type of use. And you know, what we have been told by members of the public, you know, people who live in some of these areas, that you know, there's becoming some legitimate impacts. You know, the impacts are, you know, water and wastewater impacts. There's noise. There's, you know, sort of the ongoing maintenance of the property. I don't want to say that, you know, it's a junk problem, but it's the impacts of that type of use. So the Planning Commission's been looking at this now for quite a long period of time. I'd say at least a year or more. And we haven't been able to refine it to the point that we think we have a good conversation to have with the council on some of these code changes. Well, last night, I think we got there. Is it the end product? I don't know if I would call it the end product, but it's a good draft set of regulations that look to strike that balance. It talks about, you know, number of campers or RVs that you know, property owner could have on their personal property, you know, the duration for that, making sure that we have clear language for the fact that people can store an RV on their property. It allows for property owners to have, you know, up to two campers on their property for a specific period of time on a given month. It also allows for, you know, the opportunity to have more than two on, you know, special occasions event. Going into last night, we had built in this, what we call the family reunion exception, where once a year you could have, you know, more than just the two. And the commission, you know, was supportive of that. But at the very end, they go, well, we need to be really careful about, you know, how we define, you know, family and family reunions, so that we modified the language to take care of that title, that name, family, and go to more of a, you know, a seasonal, yearly, special use, special event. So we're going to refine the language when we take it up to the council. But they did forward it up. It was important for us last night to make sure that people understood that although it wasn't a public hearing last night, they had closed the public hearing a couple meetings ago, there will be additional opportunity with the council to weigh in. And there are strong opinions and strong feelings on both sides. But I think I credit the Planning Commission, as complicated and as strongly as property owners feel about this issue, I think they've done a very, very good job of trying to strike that balance. I think it'll be further refined by the council as we move forward with the public hearing. So I'm actually pretty pleased that we've got this off High Side and up to the council, and it's not currently scheduled since it was fresh off a decision last night, but I think I would expect, if you're interested in this issue, that this will be going to the council in the real near future, within the next month, for a first preliminary hearing.
Okay, finally, I just wanted to ask you, anything with regard to the Hideout annexation, something that you're watching?
Watching, but not directly involved in. I'm not part of the existing current litigation management. It's still in the arena of the attorneys on all sides. So I wish I could give you more of an update, Leslie, but it's one I'm certainly interested in, but one I haven't been directly involved in to this point.
Okay. Hey, Pat, I'm going to leave it there for this month. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Have a nice weekend.
Pat Pott is Summit County Community Development Director. Well, earlier this week, the CDC extended the eviction moratorium from May 31st to June 30th due to the ongoing pandemic. KPCW's Jessica Lowell has more on the impacts this will have on the Wasatch Back.
The eviction moratorium was put in place by the CDC to help slow the spread of COVID-19 in congregated settings such as homeless shelters, according to a notice sent out by the center. The CDC says homeless shelters may not be able to, quote, provide adequate social distancing as populations increase. The extension comes as residents and communities across the country are still struggling to pay their rent, and the Park City area is no exception. The Christian Center of Park City offered financial support to more than 1,400 people since the start of the pandemic. Executive Director of the Center, Rob Harder, says while they were initially focused on rent, they soon realized needs were not limited only to housing security.
We gave a bunch of money out, and then got to the point where, because the eviction moratorium was put in place, we realized that for some people, the rent was no longer their number one need. And so we wanted to just make sure, you know, what is your need? Is it a car repair? Maybe it was, a lot of them, sadly, the Latinx community were disproportionately impacted by COVID. And so medical bills, they kind of had this misunderstanding that rent was the only thing we were giving, because that was the primary thing.
The Christian Center gave out more than $1.3 million last year. Even with more sectors of the economy reopening, Harder says many people are still facing financial hardship. This year, the center has given out $166,000. And he says since January, they've seen an increase in need every month.
And so it seems like, again, this is anecdotal, but it seems like a lot of people were feeling more caught up on things, on their bills, but now the first of the year, maybe they were promised a little bit more work and they were not able to get the work they thought they were going to get. So it does still seem like people are not getting full-time 40 hours a week and having to instead kind of cobble together a couple different jobs. So my guess is now they're realizing that I still have a lot of need.
The moratorium offers protections as renters are still facing financial burdens brought on by the pandemic. But when the moratorium ends in July, renters will have to pay back any overdue rent. Even though the moratorium is only a temporary fix, Harder says it's still been an overall step in the right direction.
There's still some landlords that, you know, if there wasn't a moratorium, I think they would have moved forward with evictions. And as much as we would try to help, some families have such a deep hole that, you know, even the money that we've been given would not be enough. And so the fact that they had this moratorium, what's nice about that is it was one less stressor. And so I think that's been a good thing overall.
Every year, the Christian Center hands out Easter baskets to the community. Harder says they've used the opportunity this year to continue their outreach to the community to find more families in need of assistance. He says they've also put educational pamphlets on vaccines in each basket to help bridge any gaps in vaccine disparities. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
The Park City Council met for the second time this week yesterday. On the phone with a recap of the two meetings, I have Council Member Tim Henney. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Leslie. Happy spring.
Yeah. So Council got an update on sales tax, January sales tax numbers yesterday. It looks like Park City is down a little less than 9% for the fiscal year. over 27% down compared to January 2020. We had heard that the city's finance team say that the originally expected to be down 38% for this fiscal year. So was that just a cautious estimate, or did we really do much better than expected?
A little bit of both, but, you know, if you remember back when the pandemic hit, there was, I would call it a state of panic across everybody who runs a business and, you know, is dependent upon any form of tourism sales tax. And of course, we are very focused on hospitality, lodging, and all the taxes that are generated from that. So it was a very frightening time, and you saw it everywhere. You know, it wasn't just Park City, and even locally, it was Summit County. And so budget departments went into resiliency mode and took very conservative and aggressive steps to trim budgets and to you know, adjust our projections in the future. And I think it was the right thing to do. I think it was actually, you know, we could have gone a lot further. We could have reduced full-time employees, could have laid people off. That would have been, you know, really the most dramatic step to take. And there were people who were in the community who were urging us to do that. I'm glad that we did not. I think everybody who was able to maintain employees, whether it was a private business or a public sector, you know, feels good that they were able to support those families and those people by continuing their employment. But here we are, you know, and every projection for the summer and the sales tax figures and visitation we've surpassed, you know, and you've seen it anecdotally. I've seen it anecdotally when you walk down Main Street, lots of people, lots of vibrancy. Surprising at first, right? I mean, I couldn't actually believe it when I first started seeing what was going on late June, early July, but then all through the summer and into the fall. And so, you know, it is a combination. I think we're in really good shape.
Yeah, well, and Park City has outperformed its sales tax expectations almost every month since midsummer. So I guess what's the biggest takeaway? I mean, do you see the economy in a different light now?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, that's a really good point, Leslie. We have to be careful. I think there's a phenomenon happening here that we probably did not, I don't think anybody anticipated. We thought visitation was going to be down. We didn't see visitation increasing from places where people were fleeing, whether that be the East Coast or the West Coast, and looking for shelter in places that they felt there was a lower level of risk for a variety of reasons. And I think one of those reasons in Park City is because we had the mask mandate and everybody felt, well, they felt more comfortable here than they felt wherever they were coming from, because people were diligent about wearing the masks. We didn't have high community spread. We had some spike during the summer, as we all recall, but it plateaued and then it has come down rapidly. And we've had enormous visitation. So to see those numbers come down in light of the visitation is very encouraging. And then we had all the outdoor activities. And one thing I'd like to say about that is think if we had not done the walkability and connectivity infrastructure that began 15 years ago, or whenever exactly that was. It was roughly 15 years ago with that walkability bond. And I believe Carolyn Murray was one of the, you know, real proponents and citizen activists who rallied the community around that concept. We have implemented $15 million in funds to walkability over the last 15 years, and it paid off in spades this year, because people were able to go out and go on paved trails, go on gravel trails, go on e-bikes, go on, you know, non-e-bikes, and travel around the community as groups and families, and use active transportation, use our public transportation, even though it was being run at a skeleton level. And that has paid off. I just can't imagine that we would have been viewed as attractive a place without the trails, without the infrastructure, without the walkability and connectivity. So that's been huge. And it brought people that we did not expect to see. So it's been a confluence of factors. I don't think we can necessarily count on it to continue to draw people the way it did this year, because there was a push out that came from the virus course, but and that's going to go away. But I think so many people have been exposed that we will see again, you know, Park City has put itself on the map and has separated itself from, if you want to think of it in terms of the competition, we have separated and raised ourselves from the competition once again because of those things. And so, you know, we're going to continue to see people put Park City on the top of the list of where they want to live, where they want to play, where they want to visit.
So transient room tax has been pretty hit hard over the last year,
yeah.
Down 26% or so this fiscal year. Some talk about the short-term rentals actually doing pretty well, meaning that the hotels were hit even harder than the TRT numbers show. So have you had any conversations with local hotels, and what are they saying?
Well, I think that's the conversation that's happening at the chamber, and I think you heard Jennifer speak specifically to that. They do a decimetrics study, and they get a lot of constant feedback, and that's exactly correct. The big housing lodging establishments have been hit hard, but you know, even hit hard is hit less hard than I think they projected. So where they are down significantly, and they're down more than other businesses because they don't get the same benefit from people visiting, coming from places. And, well, they don't get the same benefit from people visiting because people visiting in this certain circumstance have decided that they'd rather live in a house together as a family pod or family unit, which therefore helps the Airbnb and the short-term rental market, and it hurts the traditional lodging market where those families may have stayed for a week, and now they're coming and they're renting a house and they're staying for 2 or 3 months. So that's the dynamic at play there. But I think the chamber can, you know, kind of dig into that and pull it apart, tease it apart a little better than we can. We have had those conversations, but not to the degree and level that the chamber has. But that's what we hear from the chamber.
Okay. At Wednesday's Art and Culture public hearing, a wide range of opinions were heard on the project. Did you learn anything new about what the public thinks from that?
Well, gosh, you know, I don't know that I learned anything new. I'll just say not really new. I think what's quite surprising is the level of engagement that we're receiving. Since I've been on council, which is, 7.5 years now, I have not seen this type of input, common participation in comments, and just participation and engagement from the public on any other issue, and that includes treasure. You know, treasure was enormous, but when you just look at emails and attendance in meetings, it's really staggering. We had 180 attendees at the roundtable, and then 874 views after the fact on Facebook, the video that gets posted there, and then the public hearing that we had on Wednesday, 175 people attended, and we've had 441 views. And in addition to that, we've had 91 emails and comments submitted directly to council, which we archive. And they've been overwhelmed. Well, I mean, so if we break that down, 76% have been pro and 5 have been con. And that con is really the pro. You know, some people are pro of the concept, but then they have concerns about elements of the concept. But we put that into the pro category, and then some people are just absolutely no, we don't want to see an art and culture district here, and that's the 5. But that's, we value input, and it does matter if it's pro or con, but we just value it equally for a data point that helps us drive toward hopefully a better decision that represents the desires and goals and character and identity of the community. So that's what the attempt is, and we're getting great help. So that's the surprising part.
The majority of the concern, of course, expressed by the public centering around the financing and affordable housing. Some debate over whether or not the city has provided enough information to the public about the project. Councilmember Steve Joyce strongly felt that not enough has been provided on the financial model. What are the missing pieces there?
Well, we saw it last night, and we had a 45-minute presentation and discussion on exactly that, and we're going to come back at the next opportunity, which I think is 2 weeks from now, roughly 2 weeks, and we're going to do a deep dive on it. but it basically is taking our capital fund and our revenue streams and our projects that we already have in the pipeline, and looking at how the art and how using the available, what is available to use, and basically taking our entire ability to utilize those funding streams, which would mean that they wouldn't be available for other opportunities, and what that does over the next 10 years. And so that's the big question. Now, as Steve has said in the past, and we all understand, this is incredibly, well, let's start with everybody on council, and I think the vast majority of the community likes the concept of an art and culture district. Everybody, and maybe there are a few exceptions, are completely in favor of the city having bought the 5 1/4 acres, you know, back in 2017-18. So that's a big positive step that's been taken. And now it's what we do with that for the greatest community benefit and at what cost. So that's what we're trying to tease out. Now, Steve, you know, summed it up the other day and said everybody on council wants to see an art and culture district, but it's what are the consequences? And the consequences is, and Nan used the analogy of buying a house. You know, a lot of people buy homes and then they find themselves that they're house poor and they can't do the things that they've been doing. And maybe they have to, you know, take a look at not sending their kids to college or sending their kids to a different kind of college than they had been planning for. Or maybe it impacts their retirement plans and they have to readjust, you know, their savings and all those sorts of things. So that's really what we're doing. And we're getting into the, I would say, the real meat of it. And what we want to avoid is we don't want to cut into the bone of all the other capital projects. And that's the big concern, and I think everybody shares that concern, and that's what you're hearing from the community, and everybody on the council shares that concern. So I think we're being very responsible. We're digging into these numbers as we get them. We share them, we discuss them, we invite people in. It's all available. Everything we know is available right now to the public. And as it becomes available to us, of course, we will have the conversation in a public meeting and then have it available to share for people if they want to go onto a website and kind of tease it apart on their own. But that's, you know, I think we're making great progress, and it's not an easy project to unpack. And I think we're going to get somewhere with this. It's, you know, I'm hopeful. And I think we still have a great opportunity, and it's just a matter of how we do it. We should talk about the affordable housing component, Leslie. You want me to?
Well, I first want to just, I mean, we know for this $107 million kind of what we're getting here. But I guess what we don't know is what are we giving up if we move forward with this?
Well, that's what I was just saying. I mean, you know, we don't want to cut into the bone of everything else that we're giving up. But what we saw last night is, right off the top, we would give up the ability to buy any open space. Now, I have to say, personally, I think we've done a tremendous job as a community over 30 or 40 years of buying open space. And I would say, again, in the last 7 1/2 years that I've been on council, we bought Clark Ranch, we bought Bonanza Flat, we bought Treasure Hill, and we bought the Armstrong Farm. Now, is there any open space left to buy? I honestly don't believe there is, or if there is, there's not much. So I'm not particularly concerned about not being able to fund open space the way that we have in the past inside city limits or right on our border and boundaries. I think we've done that.
What about the
plans?
So
that goes away. And what's that?
What about the plans for the brew pub?
The brew pub lot? Parking
that's lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I, that's just not in play at this point. Yeah, but that's not open space. But so, yes, things like the brew pub, you know, those are the sorts of things that would not be possible if we were to do this, and that's the next layer. But before the brew pub, the bigger impact is affordable housing. So this kind of gets us to that. The first thing that goes away is no ability to buy open space. The second thing that goes away is we severely constrain and impact our ability to do affordable housing projects. And that one is really important and significant. And I think that's where, you know, we're really going to get to the crux of this whole issue.
Okay. Well, I do want to discuss one other issue, and that's the Quinns Junction Film Studio. council ultimately approving the amendment phasing plan for the film studio property there, giving the go-ahead for a hotel to be built in the next phase. 3-2 vote, though. The applicant wants to build a hotel to help house the filming staff during projects within walking distance of the studio. A lot of apprehension about this at the beginning, including from you. You ultimately chose to vote yes. So what made you change your mind?
Well, I think the problem that we have with the film studio is we have an approved project and a master plan development that was negotiated agreement, and they're allowed to build a hotel. And last night was really about, you know, when do they build that hotel, and was it, are they changing something that was essential to the original intent of the development agreement, which, you know, was a legal agreement that was negotiated. And my determination after a lot of process and a lot of discussion is that it wasn't changing anything at a fundamental level. It was exactly what they're allowed to do, which was a problem because the last thing I want to do is approve a hotel. And you know, Becca said it beautifully. She said, you know, the last thing this community needs, we need a hotel like we need a hole in the head. And I agree with that. You know, I don't want somebody to build a hotel out there, but that's part of the agreed to settlement, and so they get to build a hotel. Now, could we have, you know, thrown a bit of a speed bump in the process by denying it? Yeah, but you know, they would be able to get around that speed bump at some point, and it wouldn't take them too long, quite honestly. So, you know, I think Becca and Nan voted against it to, you know, show that we all do not want to approve a hotel, but we really had no other alternative. Having said that, I think the more important aspect, and maybe you were going to get here, is the applicant expressed to us a desire to explore other uses of that property. Now, that's a very, very big issue, because this, again, was a negotiated settlement that constrained the land uses, and the applicant would like to possibly change those land uses. And in the quick conversation we had last night, it was to explore land uses that would be much more aligned with community benefit. And of course, they threw out all the things that we hear from everybody who wants to do any development, being, you know, affordable housing, senior campus, all the sorts of things that, you know, that everybody dangles to get these things going. But that's really an enormous thing to want to do, and it's what you're seeing, you know, the county going through out at the tech park. So, you know, we said, well, you know what, if it would eliminate a hotel, maybe we should take a look at this, because nobody wants a hotel. So that's where it came down to. There have been pre-application conversations between the developer and staff going back over the last year, but those are casual conversations. You know, that's people sitting around and talking about brainstorming and doing sketches, and you know, that happens all the time. So this was the first official request or application for something that triggered that conversation at a level where we could actually go, huh, do we want to even explore that? And we decided that we would like to have that conversation with them and see if there's anything that might make sense to eliminate a hotel and some other stuff.
Okay. Well, here you have a great example, though, of a public-private partnership.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I mean, this is it's not really a public-private partnership, because, you know, we're the regulatory body. We're always the regulatory body. You could say that any development that comes through becomes a public-private partnership, because, you know, the private part wants to generate the best opportunity to capture profit, and the, you know, the public entity is trying to put in place regulations that align that desire to capture profit with the least harm to the community, and sometimes maybe some benefit to the community. So, you know, it's really no different than that. It's not like they're asking us to come in and invest a bunch of money to, you know, do something and leverage, you know, our power to do wonderfulness for the community, which is much more along the lines of what we're trying to attempt to do at the Art and Culture District.
Well, what he does have out there is nearly 30 acres of flat land.
Yeah, and they've got, you know, again, like I said, they've got approvals for buildings on all of that. So, and they can build that, and they will build that, according to Gary Crandall, who said he's more than happy to, you know, build out the film studio campus that he has an approval for. He's not asking us to change that, but he is saying that there might be an opportunity to re-envision that property that would still work for a film studio, but would eliminate some of the more, you know, I would say offensive aspects to the community, like a hotel, in favor of some other uses. So that's intriguing.
Okay, Tim, I've got to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Okay, Leslie, have a good day.
Park City Council Member Tim Henney. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, a kickoff event for the annual Park City Wasatch Back Alzheimer's to End Alzheimer's Walk will be held April 7th. In the studio with me, I have the co-chairs of the annual walk, Andrea and Steve Spaulding. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, so what's happening on April 7th?
So we're going to be doing a virtual kickoff, and we are asking folks to who are interested in volunteering and helping us organize the walk to join us at 6 p.m. on Wednesday, April 7th.
Okay, so when's the actual walk?
The actual walk will be on August 28th, and we are planning on doing a live walk going forward.
Okay.
Fingers crossed, yeah, we're going to.
Yeah, so tell me, how do people then participate then next week?
What we're going to do at from 6 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday the 7th, we're going to have this, and we're going to talk about what our plans are for it, and we're going to ask people to sign up for particular committees and tasks just to help us organize it. It is a, you know, to do a live walk, is a lot of moving pieces. We need a lot of people to pitch in.
Okay. And again, people can get that link then where? I mean, to participate.
They can actually... they can email our regional manager, who's Amanda Charles, and her email's aecharles@alz.org, and she can just send you the link because it's kind of a long link for us to talk on radio here.
Yeah, it's a Zoom thing. And yeah, it's a very, very long link.
Okay.
But we really want to encourage as many people as possible to come out. We have something for everybody, you know, no matter what you want to do to help volunteer, we could really use you.
Yeah. Any idea how many volunteers you would need to pull this off?
Oh, geez. I mean, we'll take everybody who's willing to come. Yeah. Like I said, a lot of moving parts and, you know, throughout the walk, I mean, we've got the organization, and then on site, we need a lot of people to help out too. So there's all different kinds of commitments, you know, before and the day of.
All right. So what did you say the date was? August 28th?
August 28th is where we're going to go for the actual walk.
Okay.
Yes.
And we're going to do
and
that.
And for that, yeah, people can start registering for that as well, too, if they want. They can just go to alz.org/walk. And then if you just put in your zip code, it'll give you all the information you need. People can start forming teams now. You can start fundraising now. We can really start getting the ball rolling right now.
Yeah. Do you have a goal in terms of how much you'd like to raise this year?
We don't, you know, with COVID and having to do this virtually last summer, I mean, we really lost some momentum. It was successful. We were very happy with the results, but of course we'd like to get back to where we were in past walks. So no, we don't have any particular expectations in mind. I mean, if we can just get the thing in person, that first and foremost, you know, it would be a success.
Yeah, I mean, it really has continued to grow. I mean, I think when you first started back in 2016 or 17, you had a couple of hundred, you nearly more than doubled it, I think, the following year. And
yeah, it's been on a good trajectory. Yeah. We just want to keep it going now.
Yeah, if we were to match what we've done, I think we had about 600 walkers and we raised, I think, about $150,000 in 2019. Yeah.
And the Wasatch Back Walk is always the highest fundraising walk in the state. So we're very proud of that.
Yeah. So how is that money then spent? Is it stay here in Utah? Or it goes
to the National Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. but you know, the Alzheimer's Association supports research. It supports giving support to caretakers. So it's well used and it's well diversified. The thing is, you know, there's a lot of concern about Alzheimer's. I mean, obviously, it's a sixth leading cause of death in the U.S., and we think it's just going to keep getting worse. So, you know, any money that can be used to finding some kind of treatment or just a way to slow it down would be huge.
I mean, there are more than 5 million Americans right now that are living with Alzheimer's, and 1 in 3 seniors actually dies of Alzheimer's or some other type of dementia. So it is just very prevalent. It kills more people than breast cancer and prostate cancer combined.
Yeah. Any idea how many we have those living with Alzheimer's here in the Wasatch Back?
I don't know about in the Wasatch Back, but no, I mean, I feel like, you know, anecdotally, you know, everybody I know, I feel, has been touched by it in some way, whether they, you know, they've experienced it with a parent or, you know, have had to be a caretaker themselves.
And I think that's the hardest thing, too, with Alzheimer's. One of the hardest things is that you need caretakers, and these caretakers end up being family and friends that are unpaid, that are just doing it because they love the person that's suffering with this. But there's a lot of hours of unpaid care that's really, you know, affects people's lives on so many levels.
Yeah, on a national level, the estimated value of unpaid care is $244 billion, right? So you just imagine all these people just having, you know, who can't afford to do long-term care or nursing homes, they're having to have their parents stay at home with them, take care of them. So it's really, you know, it's financially a huge burden. And emotionally, I mean, it isolates people, causes a lot of stress. So we would love to try to find some way to, you know, to slow this down and then eventually eradicate it.
Yeah. So why did you two become involved? I mean, you have personal experience with it as well?
I mean, I had an uncle that had Alzheimer's, and I just saw the way it affected him and the way it affected my aunt taking care of him, excuse me, and the whole family. And it really sat with me hard. And so I started getting more involved, seeing what I could do. And then I started learning more about how this affects so, so many people. And it's just on the uprise. And I just wanted to see how I could help. So I started, became a community educator. And now I'm helping out, chairing the walk, which I'm really excited for. Just anything I can do to help makes me feel better.
Yeah, and then for me, I had two grandmothers. Both my grandmothers suffered from dementia, not necessarily Alzheimer's specifically, but the mission of the Alzheimer's Association is to eradicate not just Alzheimer's, but all kinds of dementias. And then also, I work for Edward Jones, which is a national sponsor, so that's another reason why I've been extraordinarily involved in it.
Okay. Again, do you want to give us the email address that people, if they want to participate in the April 7th
Yes. You can email Amanda Charles, and her email is aecharles@alz.org, and then she'll send you the link. And please, please come out, everyone. It'll be fun. We'll have a good time. We'll be doing a good service.
Yeah, and at this point, I mean, you say we're going to do the walk. It'll be outside, so we know that we're going to be somewhat safe, maybe just staggered start
times. We're going to follow the CDC guidelines, but we are planning to move forward with a live event, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else you guys would like to mention?
No, I think that's it, Leslie. Thanks so much for having us and letting us get the word out. And again, please, anybody who is interested in finding out more about helping, April 7th, just join us on that Zoom call.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Andrea, Steve, thanks. The Utah Department of Health reporting the most COVID-19 vaccinations administered in a single day yesterday. KPSW's Jessica Lowell has the latest.
The Utah Department of Health announced 514 new COVID-19 cases, which is about 50 fewer cases than the state saw at the same time last week. In the Wasatch Back, both Summit and Wasatch County saw a decrease in cases week over week. Summit County reported 14 new cases. In comparison, last Wednesday, the county saw 12. Wasatch County reported 4 new cases, which is down from last Wednesday when the county saw 6. There were more than 6,700 people tested for the first time statewide, with around 16,600 total tests administered. On average, over 3% of tests over tests are coming back positive, while the average percent positivity for people over people is just under 7%. Utah's Department of Health reported 4 new deaths, but noted that all of them happened before March 1st. To date, more than 2,100 Utahns have died due to COVID-19, including 11 from Summit County and 21 from Wasatch County. There are around 32,000 people vaccinated for COVID-19 since Tuesday, bringing the total number to more than 1.3 million doses administered. Summit County has administered more than 28,000 total vaccines, and Wasatch County has given out just under 15,000 doses. Both counties are registering to vaccinate residents 16 years or older. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.